Welcome to the Mother Forkin' Podcast. Where we feed you some real shit on parenting. Hi, Mother Forkers. Hi,
hello.
Celeste.
Hi, Megan.
Hello.
On today's episode of the Mother Forking Podcast, we are speaking with Barbara Clark. She's the author of the recently published memoir, The Red Kitchen. And Barbara has received many labels throughout the years, some unwanted, like the best body in the ninth grade. I'm interested to hear about that one. An ex-wife twice. In her midlife, she worked in Kenya. Cannot wait to hear about that. Did my sister visit Kenya? She went to South Africa. Okay, I think I'm totally way off with my geography. I need to brush up on that. But anyway, she later developed a career as an executive and has moved over 60 times. Wow. Even a male person once told her that she held the local record for the most forwarding labels of someone not fleeing the law, which was 3. And most recently, she was given a label she treasures, earned in a class developing this memoir, most likely to start a forgiveness movement. I love that title.
I love that.
Right. So Barbara's here to talk with us about the challenges of unearthing old memories of trauma and the risk of not being believed, how important learning to live together as a mother and daughter is, especially during a pandemic, how sharing the good and bad of a family can help others with their journey of discovery, and the role of women in families and the workplace. So with her memoir, The Red Kitchen, Barbara tells how it's never too late to find and mend broken pieces within ourselves and our relationships with others. She also shows how to keep a sense of humor, which I think is super important in the worst times, and describes how to work with memory, trust, and finding long-term solutions to those traumas.
Yes. Hi, Barbara. We're so happy to have you here on our podcast. How are you doing, first of all?
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm hoping that I won't have an allergy breakout while we're talking.
And that's totally fine if you do.
Otherwise, I'm fine. I'm still, my book launch was Friday night, and I'm still kind of high on that. It was really fun. It was fun. It wasn't scary at all. I did have a little help with white wine, but other than that, it was really fun. So, and
there
I got
you
nice
go.
Feedback from people.
And congratulations with that. So
thank
speaking
you.
Of
yes.
your book, The Red Kitchen, we find it very relatable in the sense that we think that everyone, especially parents and their children, come to crossroads with one another at some point in their lives, right? And so what's beautiful about your memoir is, you know, it goes throughout childhood all the way till current. And so can you first talk to us a bit about why you decided to write the memoir, and at what point did you realize that your relationship with your mom was broken?
Well, I wrote the title story, the first chapter of The Red Kitchen, in college many, many years ago. And I had the support of the composition teacher, Mrs. Putney, who was the first real badass woman I ever met. She smoked. This was at the University of Missouri in 1961, and she walked across the campus smoking, and that was like shocking. And she
cool
cursed
lady.
The class, and so both aspects endeared her to me. And so I told her that I had this story, and she said, "Well, let me see it." And she read it, and she said, "What are you going to do with this?" And I said, "Well, my dream is to be a writer." And she said, "Well, then keep writing." Well, in my era, really what was expected was you would maybe get a job, but definitely know how to type, get married, have a husband, and have kids. So by 1961, I was on that trajectory, and that ended the Red Kitchen stories and many more. Until I went back to college, and then I started working on my stories again. And then I went to graduate school, and that's how I wound up in Kenya for a summer working on a master's degree. And so as the time went on, and then much later, I started working on these stories seriously. But this is decades worth of working. And I wrote it as a novel in the beginning. And I can talk about that as to why I thought a novel would be better. But I think it's an important story. Well, first of all, let me just back up. I didn't realize until maybe 20 years ago that people who weren't famous wrote memoirs. I thought you had to be really famous. And so I read like The Liars Club and Mary Carr's memoir and others. And I thought, wow, so they weren't famous when they wrote it. And so maybe there's room for other non-famous people. And this Red Kitchen story just wouldn't leave me alone. It kept coming up in my life. When I started writing it, I really felt like this is a story other people might share, and they might have the same issues that I had to deal with and I still deal with. And it seemed to me to be a very human story. And also I wanted to be sure that there was enough humor in it, because I read some pretty grisly memoirs, and I didn't like reading them. And I'm just not that sort of person. I really have to laugh. I got that from my mother. My mother would just burst out laughing sometimes when things were pretty awful. Because there was just no other way to handle it, but to just find the humor. Right. So I wanted to write it for people who think it's too late. It's never too late to make changes. Hope they enjoy it.
Add to that, if you don't mind me.
No.
Asking, but so you said that at the time you kind of grew up with a certain way of what was expected of women. So would you say that opening up and finding people to trust, especially at the time, because in some of your first chapters, it was very hard for you, even opening up to anyone, that was really hard for you. Mm-hmm. And then some of the topics and themes you talk about are child abuse, the complex mother and daughter relationships, even sexuality at some point, and even when you had questions about, you know, racism, that must have been really hard for you, huh?
Yeah, it was. I just didn't know anyone else was dealing with the same problems that I had. I felt, first of all, my mother really was pretty firm on don't blab our family business to anybody. So I kept quiet. And I have to say, I can't speak to it now, but I know that in the late 60s, early 70s, the women's movement really flipped my life over, because I met women who were talking about the same things I was too scared to talk about, that I didn't really think anybody else shared. I mean, one funny example was I got a phone call from one of the women in my women's group, and she said, "Can you come over?" And I said, "Where are you? You sound like you're like in the basement." She said, "I'm in the upstairs hall closet with the phone on a long, long cord. Please come or I'm going to kill my kids." And I mean, she literally didn't mean it, but she was just desperate. Yeah, and you know, it was just funny. And when I got there, her kids had these kind of like wide eyes and like, "Mom's in the closet." You know, it was just so,
that sounds so relatable. Yeah, I'm not going to lie.
And so human and so wonderful to find other people who had the same thoughts, women who never got to do what they really set out to do, women who still had dreams that they really wanted to pursue. And that kind of opened things up for me so that I did go back to school. I really realized, I mean, I always thought I would, that it was more important than ever. And then for me to have something I could call a career. And so it really changed it. And I have to say, the women's movement changed my mother in some ways, even though she was kind of a bystander to it, but she saw what was happening to me, I think. And I just have to laugh. I was thinking this morning, once my mother discovered the word patriarchy, she was like, all in. It's like, yes, count me in on this, whatever this movement is, I'm there.
That's awesome.
She had the same experience, only in another generation, you know, male bosses, men telling her what to do, no expectations that she would turn out to be anything other than a housewife and a mother. And so we shared that. And I could see that some of my big dreams I never got to have, but I had smaller dreams that I did get to complete. And my mother as well, she wanted to be a teacher, and she wound up having to go to secretarial school. But she got to have smaller dreams. And so after my father died, she really had about 20 years of just really full on, just all in kind of life with lots of friends, and people adored her because she was very funny. And just so she got what she wanted, but in sort of the smaller version, what I think she really wanted ultimately.
Yeah, it's almost like a second chance for her at that point.
What?
And the story you just told about your friend, so that's sort of the reason why Celeste and I decided that we wanted to start this podcast, is because we as mothers and close friends were going through these things all the time with our two sons. And we're like, okay, we need to, obviously if we're going through it, other people are going through it too. Other women are going through this. So let's collaborate, let's share our stories and then share it with the world. And then so many people would come to us and be like, I'm so glad that you talked about this topic. Thank you so much for raising awareness because it's so relatable. This is the stuff that we do need to talk about. Cause there were so many things that Celeste and I have both been through, you know, being pregnant, postpartum, dealing with toddlerhood, all this stuff that you don't, no one tells you about, no one talks to you about. And it's, I don't know if it's taboo or what it is, but it's like, at this point we need to talk about it. We need to raise awareness. I hate for women how back then it was so like, nope, can't talk. Nope. You're a woman.
Don't ask questions.
Yeah. You've got to be a lady. You're never going to be equal to a male, like all this stuff. But I love how, you know, it's slowly getting better as the years go on. And I think like the most recent movement, what, 2017 maybe, was Me Too movement.
Yeah.
So like stuff like that's also increasing.
And we're getting more stories out and
And
women
I love
are just
that.
Being more open.
What you referred to earlier as badass woman. I love that. And I feel like that women are becoming more. Yeah, it is my favorite. I feel like women are becoming more badass because they're like, you know what? Standing up for themselves. Like, yes, I need to be heard. I'm important too.
Being so accommodating, I wouldn't call it obedient, but in some cases it is, but being really accommodating for everything, my challenge was to stop trying to fix everything, including my family and my kids and me, mostly me, that, you know, just got so worn out.
Yeah.
And the more people talked about it, and the more, you know, women talked about it, and some men, I'm not excluding men, but being very supportive. But still, the burden of a lot of things still falls on women. I don't care what generation you're in. I mean, this one current is really, the situation with the pandemic, it's a really good example of the role of women in the culture is really, you know, we're almost back to the 50s in a way where women are at home, working now at home, you know, taking major responsibility for a lot of things in the family. And a lot of women are still way underpaid for what they're doing. And, you know, one of the things that I did when I was an executive was I stopped wearing those ties around my neck and suits, and I wore jackets and slacks. And, you know, that was, it seems so silly, but it was sort of like my rebellion. I'm not going to dress like that guy down the hall with a little silk tie. I'm not doing it anymore. And, one of the bosses I had a problem with that.
Like,
really?
There's always someone.
I have a problem with your co-cabin, but you know.
Oh, right. Oh, shoot. Shots fired.
Yeah. She went there.
No, that's but awesome. In your book, I saw a lot of myself too, because I come from a family where I grew up. My parents got divorced, and I always kind of felt that need. Like it was almost like my way of seeking attention, like to please everyone, to be the glue. So as an adult, like finding that it's okay, you're just got to worry about yourself and heal yourself. So that's I love that. That's the main theme of your book, is that it's never too late. And so I'm actually very curious to see how you respond to you and your mother fixing things before she passed, because I can totally relate on a lot of those issues.
Yeah, well, it was a really up and down journey to do that for a couple of years. Well, I went into therapy and I'm happy to talk about that, but I went into therapy, first of all, to find out what happened in my marriage, because this was I was divorced and I was on the threshold of getting a second one with the second marriage. And I just thought, okay, sister, it's time to get yourself some help. And I thought, you know, that I would be talking about my marriage and kind of like do a little cliff notes on my parents. And Oh, no, no, no. We're going way back to the very beginning. And I realized a lot of things in that first round of therapy about where how I was such a fixer in this family. And it didn't really get me anywhere because, you know, I'm not sure either one, certainly not my father was capable of fixing anything. And my mother, you can't do it alone. I mean, you can't make a marriage if there's only one person really engaged in it. So,
amen.
So, you know, I kind of, that opened my eyes. Meanwhile, there was a lot of, you know, my mother and I went back and forth. We were not always buds, especially in my adolescence. And my mother, I think, was kind of jealous that I was breaking out of the mold of wife, mother, and so forth, and was not very supportive. And when I was in therapy one day, and my therapist said to me, my parents lived, unfortunately, moved two doors away from me. So it was really like, I felt like Jane Fonda in on Golden Pond, you know, like my parents are right there. So she said, why do you think you have to see your parents so often? And I said, well, I don't know. I'm their daughter. They're getting older, blah, blah, blah. And she said, really? You think you could take a break? And I did. And I kind of got my mojo back about how I wanted to be something other than what I was. And so it was 2 years before I saw my parents again. I mean, we did Christmas cards and birthday cards, but that was about it. And
how did they take that?
Yeah, I was going to, did negative? They question that?
My mother was furious, and I understand. I mean, I said, you know, I need to take a break from the two of you. And I could see the bubble over their head going like, what? You know, like, How could you? Yeah. Or how do you, or how could you? And then she got kind of wickedly bad and in words. I mean, she, you know, by then it was just words, and she was really good at it, I got to say. So my father, in the meantime, he died, and I got to sneak in and say goodbye to him, which is in the book. And then it took me a while. And then I woke up one morning and I thought, you know, I'm down to one parent, and I only have one mother, and I would really like to have my mother in my life. And I felt like if I tried and she said no, I could manage it then, because I'd had enough kind of time and therapy to master that. And so I just put my beach stuff in the trunk of my car. It was Memorial Day Monday, and I didn't know if she'd be home or not, but I just showed up at her door, and I said, would you like to go to the beach? And she looked at me, and I looked at her, and I could see she was tearing up, and I was tearing up. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I want to be with you, but I don't want to, you know, dig out all the old stuff. I don't want to go there again, but let's see if we can have a good day together. And we did.
That's awesome.
How emotional
happened.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a tough day for both of us in different ways. I was trying to be really careful not to trigger anything in her or trigger anything in myself. And I mostly just wanted my mother back. And that was my goal for the day. And we had just a really interesting day. And I realized that just walking on the beach, which where we went as a family when my kids were younger and I was married, but on the beach gave us some kind of space where we could talk about real stuff. And one of my mother's favorite topics other than Bill Clinton, it was during the impeachment with him and Monica Lewinsky, but she was very like to follow politics, you know, but the other one was about sex. And she was just so curious about it. And I don't know, I was just, you know, it was just so fun to sort of be her friend, but to be very careful because it could have gone bad any time in that afternoon. And then it would have taken a lot of work to get back to something better for us. But
and how old were you guys at the time?
She was in her early 70s and I was in my 50s.
Were walking on eggshells? Pardon? With her a lot? Did you feel like you were walking on eggshells? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Because she, you know, I think about that this morning. I do my best thinking in the shower, and I was thinking, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, I might have diagnosed her unfairly as maybe bipolar because she could really explode. And then I thought back about how when you stuff things down and you stuff it down and stuff it down, you can't take it anymore. Mm-hmm. It just comes out, and it comes out in very unattractive ways. And I am as guilty of that as she was, only I had the benefit of therapy to see it in a more clear way. And I would say that my mother was not bipolar. I think my mother just wanted some power in her life. I think she wanted to have some things that she could call her own. And when my father died, she did. She got that, and her whole personality changed. I would say that when his thumb came off of her and she was free to be the person she really wanted to be, and I tried to support her in that as many ways as possible, she really, that bipolar diagnosis would have been terribly unfair, I think, to her. I really think it was more about being so sick of being something that she really didn't want to be anymore. That
it's really sad for her. Like back then, worse, and I've said this word already, it was taboo. Know if she ever wanted to go through. Remember the one part in the book? I don't want to.
Yeah, she did. She did think. I mean, she was pulled out of school in ninth grade and sent to secretarial school. So she didn't have that sense that she was a smart person. And in those days, I don't know, my grandmother, whom I love, but was not a great mother to my mom, said, you better be thinking about how you're going to take care of these kids. And it was too scary. And also in those days, unlike now, I mean, you had to have a reason to get a divorce. You know, your husband either had to be beating the crap out of you, or, leaving you, or there had to be something that a judge, which you can imagine was always a man at that time, would decide whether that was a worthy enough cause for you to leave a marriage. I mean, it wasn't like some mutual thing that you didn't have to blame anybody about anything. You just didn't want to be married anymore. And so all those restrictions were like holding her in. And also she stayed together because, of us, my older brother and myself. I mean, she really felt like that was her job in the world, was to, raise some kids, have the meals on the table and get the laundry done and all those jobs that she did, be the secretary for the mother's club. She didn't really see it as a possibility, I don't think. I think it was certainly an appealing idea, but I think the reality was like, it doesn't appeal to me, but I don't really want to go on a rocket ship anywhere. I don't even like to fly all that much. So, it wasn't anything that she pursued actively, except she did think about it a lot, I think. And that's why I think in some ways that I was free to get divorced, not just one, but two, kind of bugged her quite a bit, I think. I mean, when my marriage wasn't working anymore for both of them for very different reasons, I got out of them and paid a price for that as well. I mean, it was the last thing I wanted to do to my kids was divorce their dad. I mean, that was just a heartbreak, and it broke their hearts too. So it was an awful thing, but the alternative was worse. So
you sort of brought them into the picture. I would like to change gears a little bit from you and your mom's relationship to you and your kids' relationship. Going through what you went through with your mom and having that really rocky relationship growing up, and then feeling like you were walking on eggshells, how did all that affect your relationship with your children growing up and then even to today?
Quite young, 3 and 7 when I divorced their dad. And I still bear the guilt of that. It's not anything anybody ever wants to do to their kids. And our divorce was not very pleasant. So they were stuck in this kind of mishmash of, here comes your dad for the weekend and, that sort of stuff. So that was very hard. My kids are very different. I have two daughters. They're both grown, of course. One of them is very introspective and really smart and observant. And the other one is very outgoing and She was young. She was three. So it wasn't quite as traumatic for her as it was for my 7-year-old when we got divorced. And I was a single mom for quite a while and had my parents around. And I have to say, they were with my kids, but they weren't particularly helpful for me. I felt like I was on display most of the time whenever, you know, one of my kids would talk back or refuse to do something. You know, I'd see my mother taking it all in, you know, it's like, aha, you know, because one of my mother's things was, you know, I just wait until you have X and then, you know, I did vow never to say that to my kids. And I'd like to say I never did. I thought that was really awful thing to say because, you know, she couldn't wait to see it happen. And as teenagers, you know, we had our teenage stuff going on. My daughter's sister, the youngest of the two, was much more of a little rebel. And, you know, she sort of looked like, reminded me of me often. And then when my oldest daughter, she went off to France for a year after high school. And when she came back, she was like I was when I went to Kenya. She was different. She had had a year on her own and could see more about who she was. And it was a wonderful year for her, even though it was really hard. She went to France and, you know, the French really like to make fun of your accent. So, and she was fluent in French, but they still, you know, took her about 6 months for them to allow her into the French group, you know. the years, it was sometimes I would see them more often than less. You know, I mean, we have issues. If you raised your kids, they have issues with you. I have issues with them. Sometimes every once in a while, one of my kids reminds me of their dad. It's like, oh, Lord, the imprinting is incredible here. But I've lived with my oldest daughter now for about 10 years. We share a pretty small apartment, and it got even smaller when she started working from home. I write grants. I can do it anywhere. I've worked from homes. I'm not fit for corporate employment anymore. I just can't do it. I can't stand all the baloney that goes on. But anyway,
I don't blame you.
It's been a wonderful to kind of reparent for me. I can do a better job, I think, of being a mother because I'm older and I have more this. That's not to say I'm not full of flaws and, you know, say stupid things and, we have our moments, but we do a pretty good job of straightening out those moments pretty quickly. We both, I think, are uncomfortable enough with kind of discord that neither one of us really want to have that anymore. Being at odds with somebody to me is really a total waste of time.
When it comes to your own kids.
Yes. I mean, life is so short. And I mean, as much love as I can give them is what I'm really... up here is what I really want to do, because there were times when I didn't have that much love to give because I was under so much stress myself that I didn't really, it was a very flawed mother. but I realized later, starting with the women's movement, that, you know, we're all pretty flawed and, but you don't have to keep doing it, you know, so I really feel like it's a gift to me, particularly. I just said to my daughter yesterday, you know, it's like my brother is a widower. His wife died about 3 years ago and he lived alone, and he was alone because nobody was going anywhere. He was alone for about 11 months. And he was in the depths of depression about being isolated and alone and no family. His phone calls were just terrible to listen, you know. It's like I'm a good sister and I let him go, but it's like, oh Lord, I guess I have to call my brother, you know. And I love him. He's, now that he can have visitors again, he's like a changed person. Awesome. It's really, I think it's never too late to make amends, and I think it's never too late to build on the relationship that you want to have and try and get there. And I feel lucky that, I mean, my daughter and I moved in together for financial reasons. And we both just, every time our rent, we've always rented. And every time the lease was renewed, it's like, okay,
we're doing this again.
You know, I'm a grown woman. I could live on my own, but so, you know,
Well, I think that's beautiful that you've gotten there and that you're there with your daughters.
Yeah.
I do want to talk a little bit about your travels.
Yeah.
Like you said that you went to Kenya. Why was that so significant to you and your life?
Oh, well, what I knew about Kenya, I could put on a 3x5 card. I didn't really know much about it, but this opportunity in grad school came up to part of an internship through this exchange program. And I was really scared, but really ready to go. I went. I was the only parent in the group. There were seven of us. I was older than everybody by maybe a few years of a couple of people. But I went with no labels. I was not the wife, mother, daughter, sister, nothing. I was a white woman in Kenya, there to help somehow and work on a graduate degree. And that shedding of all those, I felt like, you know how tarantulas shed their shells every year? I felt like a tarantula. I just like dropped everything, and it was just so amazing. The country is amazing. The women, we were out in this most remote village in Kenya. We were at the end, literally at the end of the highway. And the women were just like the women that I knew, doing most of the work, tending the kids, tending the crops, tending the house, and were just delightful and so open. My race meant nothing to them. I got really tan. A couple of people asked me along the way, are you African-American? No, I'm just tan. And the kids were wonderful. They thought we were just so fun. And we started a women's craft collective, and I worked in their local hospital. I faint at the sight of blood, so they kept me out of anything that looked gory, but I took the hospital census and I worked with the hospital administrator and the social worker. And I just made these really, I haven't seen them in a long, long, many, many decades, but I made lifelong friends with more than some of the women there. And I didn't want to come home. I couldn't figure out how to stay. Pardon?
How long were you there?
I was there 3 months. From June to the end of August. I couldn't figure out how to stay. I couldn't see my kids in this village. Like, okay, now we're gonna live in this African village.
If they weren't mad at you for the divorce, I don't know about how they
That would have been a no-go. Yeah. But it was just life-changing. And it is that way. I think when you travel and you're not like doing five cities in 7 days where you really dig in and you're with the community. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I have to say, I grew up in the Midwest and farmed for a while after I bailed out of corporate life. And I saw again what community can be. Mm-hmm. They weren't kind of my people, but they were really wonderful community members. Mm-hmm. What I did, but I was in this room all day writing. They didn't get that, but just that sense of community. And that's what I found again in Kenya. The village was just this community, and it felt so good to me. And then, not in this book, but in 2007, 1997, I went to Cuba for 3 weeks. And I felt that same thing, very close connections between people, really looking out for each other, helping when help needed. And that just meant the most to me. So when I came back and I saw how kind of uncommunity where I lived was, even though we threw the word of community around a lot, I really saw a different world being in Kenya. And I never forgot it. And
I wonder if it has to do with the fact that like the United States is so developed and we're so far ahead of these countries that you visited. So I'm wondering if that's why it makes such a big difference with their community, because they don't have as much as we do. And they're not like, go, 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 go. And they do that are more, focused yeah. on each other within the yeah. community.
I think it could so. Be that and like cultural too.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not so sure, Megan, that we're that far ahead on a lot of issues. I think we're missing out on a lot by being, you know, a grocery store with a whole aisle full of potato chips. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I don't think that's really what life is really meant to be about. Yeah. I know it's very old fashioned, but I think we need to go back mm-hmm. to a lot of things that we have really lost. Yeah. And that was the most recent trip was to Cuba. I saw that again, you know, mm-hmm. like they were there after the Soviets left. It was a special period for them where they were really without any resources. Plus the US has always had this embargo on them and yeah. just vicious constraints yeah. on them as a people. And they manage and they do it well. And one of the things I learned from going to Kenya, and I saw it again in Cuba, is that sometimes simple is better. Sometimes, you know, getting clear on what are your values and what do you really, really care about, mm-hmm. not potato chips, but what you really care about is what makes life richer and makes yep. Families kind of thrive rather than, you see this, I see this, you know, you're out, it used to be out in restaurants, but you know, everybody's on their phone, the whole family sitting yeah. around the table. My great niece and nephew, you know, visiting my brother. I mean, he's shocked. Mm. He's older than I am. I mean, he's really shocked that, you know, the phone's at the table.
Yeah.
He wants to know, what is it that they think they're missing?
We need to go back to simpler times.
So I think that is what is our culture.
One option
yeah. for, yeah, to
for
be,
potato chips.
Yeah. Right? We have yeah. overconsumption over yeah. everything. So
yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. The role of other countries, particularly in Kenya, then and even I'm sure still now, is really disheartening. I mean, mm. we dump stuff on them that they don't need, shouldn't have, can't manage. I mean, the piles of really, like, where do these clothes come from? Just unbelievable, awful, poor quality clothes dumped in these markets. When they have these beautiful native wear that they could wear, but now they've been told to be modern. That was when we went to the movies one time in Kenya before we left, and the whole ad, there were ads in the beginning. Well, first of all, they played the national anthem and you stand in the movies. Mm-hmm. And then they had these ads about be modern. Like, no, don't be modern. Yeah. Don't do that. Yeah.
That's too bad. That's sad. Everything that we've discussed today is basically in your book. Mm-hmm. I think you probably dive a little bit deeper in your book. But I think you've already said it, but I want people to hear it again because it's important. So what is something for readers, you know, with the Red Kitchen, what is something that you hope that they can walk away from having mm-hmm. read your memoir?
Things. I hope that they'll see some things in their own family, in their own lives that resonates for them. It will not be a grim read, but that it'll be a mix, that it does have a very, I think, very hopeful and honest ending. And that it's really never too late to take care of things, do what you're, you know, follow your dream. I mean, this book, when I told Mrs. Putney in sophomore year in college that I wanted to be a writer, you know, by God, I am a writer. It just took a long, long time, but it's never too late to get those things done.
Right.
So don't wait, you know, don't put off, put off to tomorrow what you can do today, but don't put it off. It may not happen today, but don't give it up, I think. And that they will enjoy it. And it's really my story, but it's really for them. It's not my story for me.
Another big takeaway that I had was the power of forgiveness. Can uh-huh. you quickly share with us, for those struggling with that, how to navigate that? Because I think that that's a huge topic in this memoir.
Excuse me. Well, I think help is really important. If you have big issues, you can't do it alone. And I don't know that, you know, talking to a good friend is really, sometimes that's just not enough. You need, I think you need some support from friends and family if you have that. But I'm not shy about saying, I think therapy, good therapy is really essential. I don't think when I started it, it was like, oh my God, you're in therapy. You know, it was like some disease that you had to be cured. But I just think it's so helpful however you get it. Writing is very helpful to help you get through stuff, to see where you are. And having a good support group is helpful. And I don't know if it's mine to give out forgiveness. I just don't think it is. I don't even know if I can forgive myself, but I understand things. And I think I can give out, I can certainly feel compassion for people. Mm-hmm. And really at this point in my life, look at every one of us and say, you know what, we're just human beings. And we screw up and we do great things. And we need to have people who will hang out with us no matter, you know, what happens exactly. So I try and do that with my daughters. I mean, I do understand what, you know, unconditional love is. And I think that's I think that's the product of going into therapy, trying to take a look at myself and look at, you know, how I have affected other people and how other people have affected me. So,
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate having you. It's been a pleasure. We hope that people enjoy your book and a lot of stuff resonates with them. Yeah. Speaking of your book, where can people find it and how can we connect with you?
Well, I have a website. It's barbaraclark.net. And I post a blog.
Clark spelled with an E.
With an E. Right? Clark with an E, .net. And Barbara not spelled like Barbara Streisand, but you know, the regular B-A-R-B-A-R-A. I post a blog every month, and I've written some essays and so forth. That's all on my website. And I would hope that people would go to their local bookstore if they're lucky enough to have one and ask for the book there. It's available anywhere. It may not be on your bookstore shelf. And then there's always, you know, the Amazon route, but it's everywhere. It was, it came out on the 6th of April. So it's around. And I'm going to have the pleasure of going over to my local bookstore and sign some books this morning.
So, good.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
And, you know, I'd love to do some book clubs to talk more about some of the issues that are in the book and not just about the book. You can read the book and we can talk about it and I'm happy to answer questions, but I just think these kinds of conversations that you two provide are just so important. They're just make it feel like there is some kind of a community, even though, you know, we may never meet in person, but this works.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
We really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah.
We enjoyed your book. So thank you for sharing all your stories with everyone.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye. Bye.
Thank you.